Welcome to those that are joining us. We're embarking on a new project, Rabbi Nachman's Stories, which are considered by many the finest, best, highest level of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov's teachings. I'd like to refer to Rabbi Nachman by the title Rabbeinu Zal, our rabbi, to make things easier a little bit. And Rabbeinu Zal gave an introduction to these stories in which he said that in earlier times, in earlier generations, all the rabbis that discussed secrets of Torah or the deeper portions of Torah had to refer to it in disguised terms, in parables, riddles, up until the time of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai Zal. He was the first leading authority who was given permission to speak openly about the secrets of Torah, about this deeper portion. Rabbi Nosson Zal, Rabbi Nachman's main student in introducing these stories, refers to the fact that there was tremendous controversy at the time regarding everything Rabbi Nachman did, and that he himself had very mixed feelings about going ahead and publishing these stories, because he knew that there would be people that would take issue with it. There were people that took issue with everything Rabbi Nachman did. However, he said, I did hear from Rabbi Nachman's students, my colleagues, that our rabbi had said that his intention was to publish these stories. And he even mentioned the format in which he wanted to see it published, which is Lashon Kodesh, the Hebrew on top, and the common folk language, which in his locality was Yiddish, on bottom, to make it available to both learned people and people who were not familiar with Lashon Kodesh, the Hebrew language, as much, people who found it easier to understand the common language at the time, the most common language, which was Yiddish. And Rabbi Nachman had said about this, what can people say about this? You know, what complaint could people possibly have about the stories? Regardless of anything, they happen to be interesting stories. And yet, in terms of the depth of these stories, Rabbi Nachman made a point of telling his students and the people that were listening to them that each and every single detail in the story is very precise and very important. And changing any iota, any detail of the story, will definitely detract in a big way from the meaning of the story. He also said that these stories definitely are on a level to be lectured in public, in synagogues, in places of learning. And Rabbi Nosson Zal, Rabbi Nachman's main disciple, writes that during the time of the Baal Shem Tov lived 50, 70 years before Rabbi Nachman, and the Baal Shem Tov was known as one of the leading tzaddikim of his time. And it was known that when there were emergencies, when there was a very important issue that had to be addressed, that required communication with heaven, or that required a tzaddik interceding on behalf of the Jewish people to heaven, there were times that the Baal Shem Tov saw that he couldn't accomplish what he needed through prayer, and he would resort to telling a story. That this was considered, in fact, even a higher level than tefillah, in being able to be miyached yichudim, in order to be able to bring about a unification, a spiritual unification in heaven that was needed to remove a decree, or to see to it to bring down a blessing of good health or wealth or whatever type of need that a person, a particular person or a community needed at the time. Right before Rabbi Nachman introduced the first story, he said that in the stories that people tell in the world, you know, those famous stories, there are very deep messages there. However, very often, the stories are not being told in the exact sequence, in the exact format that they should be. And for this reason, people don't get the message. People don't realize the depth behind it, and they don't get what they're supposed to be able to take out of it. And very often, there are parts of the story that are missing, or parts of the story that have become confused. However, the truth is that even in the stories that are told in the world, we're talking about stories that have become famous, there is tremendous depth to them. Now, these 13 stories that are presented in this book specifically, Rabbi Nosson Zal writes The majority of them are brand new stories that Rabbi Nachman told, that he got from wherever he got them, but that were not known, that weren't introduced into the world ever before. Some of the stories, Rav Nosson Zal writes, a minority, a few of the stories mentioned in this book are known in the world. However, again, there are parts that are missing. In the way that the world knew these stories, there were parts missing, there were parts that had been changed, mistaken, and Rabbi Nachman, in his presentation of the story, is obviously presenting the corrected, full version of the story to be able to accomplish the total of what can be gotten from this story. When he was about to begin telling these stories, he said, "Now I'm going to have to start telling stories," implying that after all the powerful material that I fed you till now, all of my lectures, all of my teachings, all of my speeches that I struggled so hard to convey to you and to help you through them return to Hashem and be elevated spiritually, and since I see that after all of that, you're still not where I want you to be, I haven't elevated you to the level I'd like you to be at, therefore, I'm going to have to resort to telling stories. And that's when he began with this first story. In chapter 60, in Likutei Moran, in the first half of Likutei Moran, Rabbi Nachman makes a statement. He refers to the fact that people know that stories very often are told to help put people to sleep. And Rabbi Nachman, in this chapter in Likutei Moran, says that when a person is asleep spiritually, the most powerful and the best tool possible to wake the person up and to liven them up and to give them the energy that they need, to have the encouragement and the motivation that they need to move forward, is the right kind of story. And there he refers to two different levels of stories. He mentions that there are stories, Mikerev Shonim, there are contemporary type stories, which he says are important and powerful and meaningful. And then he says there are stories, Mishonim Kadmonios, there are stories, ancient stories, stories that go way, way, way back, hundreds or thousands of years back. And he says those are the kind of stories that are the most powerful medicine in the world to be able to revive and restore a dormant soul, a soul that's asleep or that's ill or that's weak in any kind of way. These stories are the most effective possible in being able to awaken that soul and restore it and refresh it. With this introduction, I'd like to dive into the first story. Rabbi Nachman began by saying, on the road, while traveling, I told a story which anyone who heard that story had an awakening of tshuva. And this is the story. Now, Rabbi Nachman's followers used to say that this term, on the road while I was traveling, is a short way of summarizing every single person's life in this world. All of us in this world are travelers. We're traveling through, we're passing through. None of us has been here for thousands of years, and none of us intends to stay here past 120 years. So all of us are baderech, and a story, when a person is living in this world, a story that brings about inspiration for tshuva, spiritual inspiration, that's a story that's worth telling. And a story that has anything but that, what value is there to it? And this is the story that he told. There was once a king who had 6 sons and 1 daughter. And this daughter was very precious to him. And he loved her to an extreme, in a very, very big way. And he would enjoy, he would spend time with her and enjoy her immensely. One time, when the king was together with his daughter, on a particular day, he got angry at her, and in his anger, he made a statement that the no good one should take you. That night, she went to her room, and the following morning, no one knew where she was. And her father, the king, was in tremendous pain over this. And he went searching for her, here and there, in all kinds of places, without any success. The king had a viceroy, an assistant, Rabbi Nachman refers to him as Sheni Lamelech, second to the king, who, when he saw the suffering that the king was going through over the fact that his daughter was lost, his daughter, the princess, was lost, he decided that he's going to do whatever it takes to be able to find her. And he requested that the king give him three things. One is a servant, the second is a horse, and the third is money for expenses. And this second to the king, this viceroy of the king, set out to search for this lost princess. And in fact, the name of this story, the title of this story is The Lost Princess. And he searched for her a lot, a tremendous long time, until eventually he found her. And now Rabbi Nachman's going to go about describing this search. He went to all kinds of places for a long period of time. And he went into the deserts and fields and forests. And he searched for her a very, very long time. One time, while he was traveling through a desert, he saw a path to the side. And he thought to himself, since I've been traveling for such a long time through this desert, and I haven't seen any trace of her, I haven't been able to find her, maybe I'll try this path to the side, and maybe it'll lead me to a place of civilization, a place where I'll find her. Sure enough, he took this path, and he went for a long time. And then, eventually, he came to a fortress, a gigantic fortress, and he saw many soldiers surrounding it. And this fortress looked beautiful. Everything about it was neat, beautiful, orderly, with all the soldiers, each one in the position in the right place. And this viceroy to the king was very afraid of these soldiers, that if he would want to try to get in, who knows if they'll let him get in. Then he thought to himself, I'll try. I'll go and I'll try. So he left the horse and he went to this fortress. And sure enough, nobody stopped him. He went inside, and he went from room to room without anybody blocking his path in any way, until finally he came to one big palatial room, and he saw the king sitting there with his crown and some special soldiers that were there, and musicians who played music in front of the king. And it was something very beautiful there. And neither the king nor any of the other people there asked him any questions. He saw all kinds of delicacies, delicious foods. And he stood up and he ate. And then he went to lie down in a corner of the room to watch what would take place. And at one point he saw that the king gave a command to have the queen brought before him. So they went to bring her, and there was a tremendous amount of noise and joy, and the musicians were singing and playing about the fact that the queen was about to be presented. And they prepared a special chair for her, and they sat her right next to the king. And she was this princess. She was this lost princess. The viceroy, the king, looked and he recognized her. And then, sure enough, she looked and she saw a person lying down in a corner there, and she recognized him. And she got up from her throne and she went there to where he was lying and she touched him. And she asked him, do you recognize me? And he said, yes, I recognize you. You're the lost princess. And he asked her, how did you get here? She said to him, my father had made a statement. He had said that term that the no good one should take you, and this is the place of the no good one. So this viceroy told her that her father is suffering terribly with her absence, and that he searched for her for many years. He told her that her father is suffering tremendously, and that he, the viceroy, the king, had been searching for her for many years. And he asked her, how can I take you out of here? She said to him, it's impossible for you to be able to take me out of here unless you follow the following procedure. You have to choose a place and stay in that place for a year, for an entire year, and throughout the entire year to be yearning and wanting very, very much to be able to rescue me, to be able to take me out of here. That should be your main focus, the main thing on your mind. And whenever you have a free moment, you should be focused only on this, thinking and wanting to take me out of here. And during this year, you have to do a lot of fasting, abstain from eating and drinking, and especially on the final day of the year, you have to make sure to fast that day, and also not to sleep the entire day. No eating, no drinking, no sleeping that entire final day of the year. The viceroy heard this, and he decided to do it. Sure enough, he found a place, and he did exactly what she had done, what she prescribed. And on that final day of the year, he was fasting, and he hadn't slept at all, and he was obviously, the day was coming to a close, and he got up and started traveling, started going towards where she was to be able to take her out. As he was walking, he saw a tree, and on it were growing very beautiful apples. And these apples looked very inviting. Sure enough, he stood up and he ate. And as soon as he ate the apple, he immediately fell asleep and slept for a very long time. And his servant tried waking him without any success, couldn't wake him up. After a long while, he woke up from his sleep and he said to his servant, where in the world am I? Where in the world am I? And the servant told him exactly what had happened, that you've been sleeping for a very long time, many years, and throughout that period of time, I've been living from the fruit here. So this Sheni Lamelech, this viceroy to the king, felt terrible. And he went to the place where he had seen this lost princess before, earlier, and he found her. And she also was obviously very upset, felt terrible. And she said to him, if you had come on that day that I told you, that final day of the year, you would have been able to take me out. And because of that one day, you lost it. You lost the opportunity. Even though on one hand, not to eat is something quite difficult, especially on the final day, when a person's been fasting throughout a year, different times, and this is the final day, then the Yetzirah, the evil inclination, works strongest to get the person to mess up. And in saying this, she was implying that I understand how difficult what I asked you to do was, and therefore, now I'm going to make it easier for you. You're not going to have to abstain from eating completely. But rather, once again, I want you to choose a place, pick out a place, and stay there for an entire year. And on the final day of the year, you're allowed to eat, just no sleeping, and no drinking wine. Because wine is something we know that could lead to sleeping. because the most important issue is the sleep. The most important issue here is to avoid sleeping. Sure enough, this viceroy to the king went and he followed her instructions. He did exactly what she told him to do. He picked out a place, he stayed there for the entire year, and throughout the year he longed for her. He thought about wanting desperately to be able to get her out of there. On the final day of the year, he started heading to the place where she was, and while he was traveling, he saw a stream, a flowing stream. And this stream looked strange. Instead of water in it, he saw it was red. The liquid was red, and it smelled like wine. So he said to his servant, he asked the servant, "Have you ever seen such a thing? Look at this. This is really strange. This is a stream. A stream, everybody knows, usually has water flowing in it. And yet, it's red and it smells like wine." And sure enough, he went over and he tasted from the wine. And again, he fell down and fell asleep immediately for many years. For 70 years. During those 70 years, there were many soldiers that passed by, soldiers with their wagons, with all the things that usually accompany them when they're traveling, large groups of soldiers. And the servant hid himself because when he saw these huge numbers of soldiers coming, he went to hide. Afterwards, at one point, he saw a chariot, a beautiful chariot, in which this princess was sitting. And she came out of the chariot and stood next to where this Sheni Lamelech had fallen asleep. She went over to him and she sat down next to him and she recognized him. And she shook him very, very hard, trying to wake him up, and couldn't. And she started to plead with him about how terrible she felt. "You've worked so hard, you struggled so hard for so many years to be able to rescue me. And just because of that one day, you lost the opportunity to be able to rescue me and take me out." And she cried a lot over this, because she said, this is such a pity on you and such a pity on me, that it's such a long time that I'm here and I can't get out." Then she took the kerchief from her head and she wrote on it with her tears. And she placed that kerchief next to him and she got up, she went back onto her chariot and left. Afterwards, after this 70 years had passed, he woke up and he asked his servant, "Where in the world am I?" And the servant told him this whole story, that many soldiers had passed by here and there was a beautiful chariot that had stopped, on which this princess was, and that she came out and she cried over you and she screamed that it's such a pity on you and on her. Suddenly, the viceroy to the king looked and he saw this kerchief next to him. So he asked, "Where did this come from?" So his servant told him, "She wrote on this kerchief with her tears." The viceroy took this kerchief and lifted it up towards the sun. And he started to see letters written on this kerchief, and he saw that she had written on this kerchief all of her suffering and everything she had been through. And she wrote that now she's no longer in that fortress anymore. But rather, if he wants to find her, he's going to have to search for a mountain of gold and a fortress of pearls. That's where you'll find me. At this point, the Sheni Lamelech, the viceroy to the king, left his servant, and he went alone by himself to search for her. We had seen previously that he had left the horse when he wanted to enter into that fortress the first time. He left his horse. Now, at this stage of the story, he leaves his servant, and from this point he goes on alone. And he went for many years to search for her. And he thought that in a city or in a civilized place, he's not going to find a mountain of gold and a fortress, a pearl fortress. The only place, because he was familiar with the map, different countries, different cities. Therefore, I guess I'm going to have to go into the wilderness, into deserts and places like that. And sure enough, he went to search for her in these places, in uninhabited places, for many, many years. Finally, after many years of searching, he saw a very large person that didn't look human at all whatsoever, gigantic. And this person was carrying a huge tree, which in a civilized place, you'd never see such a thing. In a city, you'd never see such a thing. A tree so tall. So this person said to him, "Who are you?" He said, "I'm a person." And he was surprised because he said, "I've been here in this wilderness for such a long time and I've never seen a person here." So this is what this tall person said to him. So the viceroy to the king told him the whole story. And he told him that he's searching for a mountain of gold and a fortress of pearls. So this giant said to him, "No such thing. You're not going to find anything like that." And he told him that this is ridiculous because there's no way in the world you're going to find something like that. And this viceroy to the king started crying tremendously, because he knew that he has to find, she's got to be in a place, and she had told him that she would be in this type of place. And yet, this huge giant kept telling him, "There's no such thing. Somebody told you something ridiculous, silly." And yet, the viceroy was adamant and persistent, and he said, "I know there definitely is such a place." So now this giant said, "My opinion is that this is foolish. There's no purpose to this. However, since you're being so stubborn about this, I am appointed over all the wild animals, non-domesticated animals. What I'll do on your behalf is I'll call all the animals together, because the animals go all over the world. Maybe one of them will know. Maybe one of them has come across this mountain or this fortress." Sure enough, he summoned all the chayas, all the wild animals, from the biggest, smallest to the biggest, all different types, and he asked them if any of them had seen such a thing, and all of them said, "Never. We've never come across such a place." So the giant said to him, "You see, they told you something ridiculous, something silly. If you want to listen to me, go back, because you're not going to find any such thing. There is no such thing in the world." And yet he insisted. The viceroy wouldn't quit, wouldn't give up. He persisted and he said, "I know that there definitely has to be such a place." So this giant said to him, "Further on in the wilderness, there's a brother of mine. This brother of mine is appointed over all the birds, all the different species of birds in the world. Maybe they know. They fly high up. Who knows? Maybe they've seen this mountain and fortress. Go to him, tell him that I sent you, and we'll see what happens. Sure enough, the viceroy went for many, many years to search for this brother of the giant. And sure enough, he found another giant who was also carrying a gigantic tree. And he asked him also about this mountain and fortress. And he told him the whole story that his brother had sent him. And sure enough, he also rejected him and said, "There's no such thing." And the viceroy insisted again. And this giant said to him, "I am appointed over all the birds. I'm going to summon all the different kinds of birds. Maybe they know." He summoned them. He asked all of them, from the smallest to the largest, and they all said they don't know of any such thing, never come across such a thing, a mountain of gold, a fortress of pearls. So he said to him, "You see that there's no such thing in the world. If you listen to me, go back, because there definitely is no such thing." And this viceroy to the king insisted, and he said, "There definitely is such a place in the world." So this second giant said to him, "Further on in the wilderness, you'll find my brother, who is appointed over all the winds. These winds blow all over the world, every place. Maybe they know." So the viceroy to the king traveled for many, many years to search for this third brother. Sure enough, he found a giant also carrying a very large tree, and he asked him about it, and he told him the whole story, and this third brother also rejected him, said, "No such thing, I don't know of any such thing, there is no such thing." And the viceroy to the king insisted again. So this third giant said to him, "Because you're so insistent, I'll invite all the winds. I'll summon all the different winds. We'll ask them." Sure enough, he summoned all the winds, and they all came, and he asked all of them. None of them knew of any such mountain and fortress. So the third giant said to him, "You see that they told you nonsense." And once again, the viceroy to the king started crying a lot. And he said, "I know that there definitely is such a place." Suddenly he saw that another wind came along that hadn't been there previously. So the one who was appointed over the winds got angry and said, "Why did you come late? Where were you when all the other winds came? Didn't I decree that all the winds should come? Why didn't you come with them?" So this wind said, "I was delayed because I had to carry a princess to a mountain of gold and a pearl fortress." At this point, the viceroy to the king was filled with joy. And he asked, so the giant, this third giant appointed over all the winds, asked this wind, "What's expensive over there? Which things are important and precious in that place by the mountain of gold and the pearl fortress?" So the wind said, "Everything there is very expensive." So this giant, who was appointed over all the winds, said to this viceroy, "Because of the fact that you've been searching for her for such a long time, and you've put so much effort into this, and I'm afraid that money shouldn't be an obstacle to you now. Therefore, I'm going to give you a particular vessel, a keli, a vessel, which when you put your hand into it, you'll be able to take out money, whatever money you need." Then this third giant decreed that the wind should take this viceroy to the king to that place. Sure enough, a storm wind came along and carried him to that place and brought him to the entrance. And there he saw soldiers standing that wouldn't let him go into the city. He put his hand into the vessel, he took out money, and he bribed them, and they let him go in. And the city was beautiful. And he found a wealthy person in the city, and he paid him for lodging, because he knew he'd have to spend time there, because he knew that it's going to take tremendous wisdom to be able to figure out how to get her out of there. And exactly how he succeeded in getting her out, Rabbi Nachman did not tell, but he said eventually the viceroy to the king succeeded in getting her out. This is the conclusion of the first story of this series of 13 stories. We could discuss this for years, but we'll try to capsulize and we'll try to cover some of the interpretations and commentaries and elucidations that are given specifically by Rav Nosson Zal, Rabbi Nachman's primary student, and by some of his most learned followers that came afterwards. One king, who had six sons and one daughter. The one king, Hashem Echad. The six sons and one daughter could refer to many different things. Among them, we know that the Torah is divided up into two sections. It's divided up in many different ways, many different formats. But in one place, the Gemara quotes a pasuk describing the six sections of the Talmud. And it refers to them based on a particular pasuk. V'hoya emunas itecha chosen yeshuas chochmas vodas. And it says that the six words in that pasuk refer to the six sections of the oral Torah, which span the full spectrum of knowledge. Because we know the oral Torah is the clarification of the written Torah. It's taking the written Torah and expounding it, exploring it, clarifying it in the fullest sense. So that's what the six sections of Mishnah refer to. And after listing those six, the pasuk says, Yiras Hashem hi otsoro. But the treasure of Hashem is true fear of Hashem. Meaning that knowledge is something that's very important, very precious, and it's one of the important links to Hashem. But it doesn't compare in any way, it doesn't hold a candle to Yiras Hashem, fear of Hashem, respect for Hashem, the basic respect, a simple respect from Hashem that's not coming necessarily from deep knowledge, from philosophizing, but rather a simple, sincere respect for Hashem. And the pasuk says that this is the treasury of Hashem. This is what Hashem loves most. And there are many places throughout the Torah where we're shown that as good as it is and important and precious and respectable for a person to be knowledgeable and for a person to study, the most important thing, far more important than that, is this respect, this Yiras Hashem. This is one of the interpretations of the six sons and the one daughter, and why Rabbi Nachman tells us that the daughter was very, very precious in the eyes of the king. We know that the world was created with 6 days and a seventh day. The 6 days of the week represent a concept of Yemei HaChol, weekday, something that is non-holy. The seventh day of the week, which is the Shabbos, is referred to as the Shabbat Queen, Shabbos Malkasa, the Shabbat Queen, and is the greatest manifestation of our faith in Hashem, belief in Hashem. The Torah tells us that a person who observes Shabbos gets credit as if they observe the entire Torah, and a person who desecrates the Shabbos, it's considered as if they rejected the entire Torah, because one of the most powerful foundations of faith in Hashem is the Shabbos. And that again is one of the representations in the six sons and the one daughter, and how the daughter was so precious in the eyes of the king. The daughter representing this issue, this concept of emunah, faith, which is, again, so important and so precious, and is referred to very often, generally, Rabbi Nachman mentions this several times throughout Likut Emran, that usually learning is attributed to the men, to male, and faith, sincere faith, and respect for Hashem, Yiras Hashem, is associated with the female. In Eshet Chayil, that we recite Friday night from Mishlei, we say, Isha Yirat Hashem Hi Titalal. The woman of valor, the woman who has respect for Hashem, she is praiseworthy. So that this Yiras Hashem, this Amuna, is usually associated more naturally with the woman than with the man. This concept that one day the king got angry and made a statement that the no good one should take you. We know that anger, unfortunately, leads to people saying things that they don't want to say, that they feel sorry about afterwards. And once a word leaves a person's mouth, usually it's very, very difficult to retract it. We know that Kaviyachol, Hashem himself, we find throughout the Torah many examples where Hashem swore a particular decree that Moshe Rabbeinu would not enter into the land of Israel, that the Jews who left Egypt, those who were 20 years and older, would have to die out in the desert, or many other examples of decrees which once the decree was said, many cases it was very, very difficult to retract, to be able to undo. And this concept of nighttime, at night she went to her room, and in the morning they couldn't find her. Nighttime is usually a time that's associated with the forces of evil. That's a time when different forces of evil, whether it be animals that prey, you know, that kill, or stalkers, thieves, murderers, that's their time for being effective, for being active, most active. And the king was very, very upset. Now this, the term the princess here, throughout all the Kabbalistic writings and throughout the Torah, not only Kabbalistic writings, but even in the prophets and the Nevi'im, we have this term, the queen or the princess of Hashem, which is a term that's used to refer to the Jewish people as a whole. The Jewish people represent the queen of Hashem. We know that Matan Torah, when we celebrate Hashem giving the Torah to the Jewish people on Mount Sinai, it's referred to as a wedding between Hashem and the Jewish community, Knesset Yisrael. And this Knesset Yisrael is referred to as the bride or the queen or the princess. These are all terms that are used interchangeably throughout the Torah, referring to the Shekhinah, the spirit of Hashem. And we're told that all the good deeds that we do help to bring about a unification between Hashem and the queen. And the misdeeds that we do, the sins that we commit, all the mistakes that we make, lead to a separation between Hashem and the spirit of Hashem. We'll hold it over here for right now. We'll try to pick up in the next session, continuing to interpret and explain and clarify. The next session will be Emir Tzashem the following Sunday, same time, 5 p.m. Jerusalem time, 10 a.m. New York time. If there are any questions or comments, we'll open the floor now for that, please. A question was raised, why would Hashem say to his queen, to his Shabbat queen, that the no good one should take you? The symbolism that's being used here, and this we're told throughout the Torah, that when you have a king who has a child, a prince or a princess, and the child does something wrong, something terrible, and the king gets angry at the child sometimes to the point where he has to throw the child out of the room, throw the child out of the house even at times, and the king wants to guarantee that he's not going to forget that child. What does he do? He sends the mother out too. He sends the queen, that's your kid, your child is the one that made that mess. You go with him. You take him out of here, and you go with him until he gets his act together, until he straightens out. And this is not being done in a manner of hate or anger. This is being done as an act of love to ensure, to guarantee that the king, a king without a queen is completely empty. And this is the king's way of guaranteeing that he will never forget his son, you know, the child for a moment, that this will always be first and foremost in his mind. Again, this is all symbolism that's being used to represent examples of things that happened in the history of the world, in Jewish history, and how Hashem conducted himself with the Jewish people as a whole, or with each and every individual Jew going through their own personal circumstances.